Hello, Charlie Clemmers here. You're listening to the European Echo podcast. You can find us on europeanecho.com. You can also subscribe to the European Echo podcast on the podcast app on iPhone or Android. For this, the third installment of the podcast, I'm joined by artist Xavier Robles de Medina. At the time of recording, Xavier was preparing intensely for his first solo exhibition in New York City at Katinka Tabakaru Gallery on the LES, and was trying to balance finishing a book to coincide and build on the work of the solo. But he remained his usual lucid self. I am aware that it's a little shorter than the previous two podcasts and more of an interview. To make up for that, I'm going to record something on my own, which will take the form of a more explicit discussion of Xavier's work. This will complement the ensuing discussion, which is more of a snapshot of the kind of conversations we've been having over the past few months. So stay tuned for the second part. In what follows, we mostly talk about the politics and creativity of consumption. Sounds cryptic, but it's simpler than that. I think, though, I'll leave it there for explanation and let the conversation speak for itself. So, enjoy. We've spent a lot of time before talking about consumerism, about how people who aren't creative per se can make deeply creative choices with what they buy. Do you think that this kind of creativity can be as interesting as that of an artist?
I don't know if it's as interesting, but it is. I think to them it has a similar value to what writing a great article for you might be, like, or writing a great piece of fiction, like you're something that you're really proud of. I think for someone, if they feel like they bought like this amazing thing, this beautiful, extremely useful, valuable thing, and they're gonna have it for the rest of their life, and it's theirs, it's no one else's, it's their property, I think it's just as valuable to them as that experience is for you, a feeling kind of a sense of purpose through what you've made. The most important question is probably what the intention is behind someone's choice in purchasing something. Is what value does it have for them? If it's a trend, or if it's a peer pressure kind of situation, that can be just as awful as someone trying to do a particular type of writing or trying to do a particular type of painting that's the same kind of peer pressure or something that seems corrupt or something.
I guess categorizing what is and is not a good decision, or what is or is not an authentic thing, is the level of intellectual laziness in the process of creating it. Laziness is one of the worst things that you can be accused of as an artist, and it's the same way for a consumer.
But I think what's even worse than laziness is dishonesty. Like, I think there are people, like, they work really, really, very hard and just create things that are kind of meaningless because they're just not true. They're just maybe following a kind of formula. If you understand how to generate clicks, you know, you start to kind of change your content or change your whatever you present on your website to fit in what you want people to click. Well, I think after a while, you might not even remember what the purpose was of why you wanted to write or what you wanted to say in the first place, because you've become obsessed with generating popularity or something, that it just has completely defeated the purpose.
So I was going to say that there's a parallel between artistic laziness and the impulse buy. That feeling when you've bought something on impulse and you're disappointed with it afterwards, and you get that feeling of flatness and you think, fuck, that wasn't worth it. It didn't give me that pleasure. I guess the parallel with dishonesty is probably something like buying something that's not yourself, something that you bought because of peer pressure. Talking about this, I'm reminded of my dad. He's very austere and into the environment, but he reads this magazine, Auto Trader, a car magazine, and he just looks at the cars and he thinks about them, and he looks at how efficient they are, and he really looks at the mileage of his own car and takes an avid interest in other people's cars. And when he eventually does buy a car, you can tell he's really pleased with it. It's very sweet, because he doesn't want to admit it He's the most frugal person, and he still has this very... It's not impulsive, it's compulsive interaction with consumption.
But his interaction is kind of like a real creative.
And I think that's really authentic, honest consumption. It really reminds me that consumption isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just compulsive consumption that can be.
Or yeah, I mean, it can be vacuous or it can be very meaningful and rich. It's like, it's whatever the person's relationship is to it. Yeah, my grandfather was kind of also similar to that from stories that my mom tells me. He ran a print company. He would do printing banners and printing signs and all these things. But he wore the same thing every day. Like he had maybe 5 outfits and like a clean one for every day of the week, and kind of just looked like a factory worker. He just, my mom says, if anyone like went in to this workspace and was looking for the owner of the company, they like would never have guessed that it was him, because it just looks like he just looks like a factory worker, and he wears the same thing every day. But his joy was really just in like creating things, making these products, which is like an extremely commercial platform, creating these like advertising signs and banners. And but it's not something that I don't think he did as, I think it's like a kind of a creative thing more so than this obsession with money or consumerism, or I think he felt that he was contributing.
But then again, generally speaking, there's an active effort to stop people from thinking carefully about a product, about its quality and the process behind its production. I guess wherever you go, personal consumption is much more of a mediated thing, where someone is telling you how to respond to it. Whereas with art, it's up to you. And I think that's definitely the case with your work.
Yeah, but it very much depends on the context. Because I feel like I'm kind of in the position where I can say, okay, I just assume that people will value it enough to think about it, spend some time with it, because I'm presenting it hopefully at an art gallery amongst other artists that I respect. But if I was exhibiting in a different context, in a cafe or in a restaurant, it's just a different response that you should expect. And I've exhibited in cafes. It's no one's reason for being in the space. Mm. It's never the art.
Yeah.
Of course. So your relationship changes somehow to the viewer. And the same drawing or the same piece can have a completely different value or meaning depending on where it's presented and depending on who it's seen by, who is observing it or who's taking it in, and where is it being exhibited. It's very it's very relative in that sense. It's kind of like you could put like a real Louis Vuitton bag in a Louis Vuitton store. People expect to be spending thousands and thousands of euros on this bag in this setting. But if you put the same bag on the street with some street salespeople, you wouldn't even maybe expect to be spending more than 100 euros on it or something, even though it's the same bag and it's real, and people just have no way of really recognizing it if the context isn't appropriate or if it's different. So if I was showing the exact same thing in a context that it's maybe makes it undervalued.
But it's dangerous though, right? Because objects become these mystical items that require huge amounts of human imagination to perpetuate their significance.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess you are kind of telling people what to feel or what to the value to experience, but you're not writing it down on paper. You're creating a context that makes them maybe kind of subconsciously even see that. I think the thing is that most artists or writers or musicians are probably worthy of like 5 levels better than they're showing at. But it's the decision, it's the self-validation that is almost the only factor in what their space is. It's like, it's purely a matter of saying, I do or I don't belong here, or I'm fine with this or I'm not fine with this, and I deserve this or I deserve better, or I don't deserve this at all. It has nothing to do with the work. It's just a matter of, it's kind of a matter of arrogance, and how arrogant and how arrogant are you and how big is your ego, and
how much energy you have to be arrogant as well, right?
It's exhausting.
Do you think with your output that there's a similar dynamic? How you spend your time, I guess, and where it counts, and likewise what galleries you go for?
I think what's kind of strange is that I think if you've broken through a certain level, I'm not exhibiting at cafes. And the reason I'm not exhibiting in cafes is because I know that I'm a lot more, that my work is a lot more valuable than art in cafes. That people don't value art in cafes. So I believe that my work deserves to be valued by other people because I think it's valuable what I'm saying. And so I feel like it deserves to be in a context which is respected and cherished. And I think that context is the gallery setting. And then I think once you are exhibiting it at a certain type of gallery, which is, I think every gallery has an identity, and you can decide for yourself what kind of identity you feel works for you and makes sense. And then the gallery also has to feel the same, that they connect with your work. But if I feel like, at least what it looks like to me so far, is that if you're past a certain point, you continue to find particular people, for instance, that are drawn to your work. Like, I exhibiting my work and seeing who's attracted to it. It's not that broad of an audience. It's not young, attractive people that are interested in my work. It tends to be older people. For some reason, I don't know what that is. And I think it's not like young, fresh work. It's kind of like very patient, very, it's not old, but it has like a certain appeal to.
It's kind of a conservative thing, right? But I mean, in these times, small C conservatism is completely reasonable.
Yeah. I mean, I think if everyone is making work that looks like avant-garde, then what is actually the experimental, the avant-garde, what does that space look like? You know, like if everything looks avant-garde, if everything looks unfinished process, and it's kind of reversed. And I think that's kind of interesting. But what I have realized is like, I didn't really make my point earlier, is that I feel like I have, in a way, found the appropriate setting for my work. I think if you make a particular kind of work that you deeply believe in, that it's going to attract the people who believe similar things to you, or it's going to attract the right people, I think. Like, a lot of, from the exhibitions I've done so far, or the people that have approached the gallery or me for purchasing works or doing exhibitions or something, it tends to be people that I also appreciate. So I think that's kind of a nice place to be in like a young career, because it's very promising and it's very exciting to aspire to continue making work that is very meticulous, and that you continue to be very specific about, and very wouldn't settle for anything less than like deeply, deeply emotional and inspired. And it's not the easiest kind of work to make, but I think it just does pay off, and it's exactly the company that you want to have be attracted to it. So
just thinking about my own work, when I've spoken to friends, they've said you should follow your own thing, what you're interested in, what you believe in, and not follow what pays, or at least not necessarily. And I guess they wouldn't say that if they thought he really needs to stop what he's doing. But then this act of doing, of course it mostly produces its own refinement in the process. But it's just hard, you know? It's not like when I set out producing something that I know how it's going to end up. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think quite a lot of objective kind of thinking is required, and that's hard because it's kind of difficult to really look at what you've made and be like, this sucks, or this is exactly what I like. Like, would you enjoy a piece of writing that you've done if you were just stumbled upon it online, or would you get anything from it? And then sometimes it takes like a particular character to be able to say, no, this just isn't very good writing, or it isn't very good drawing, or it isn't very interesting. So like, how do you get to a mental space where, or a space in your work ethic and in your creative process where you can be both like deeply inspired and very sincere, but at the same time kind of be objective in a way and be like, no, this is not exactly what I would objectively enjoy, even though it's based on something sincere? Or
do you feel like some of your drawings are trying to create deliberately thoughtful statements?
No, I'm not deliberately creating thoughtful statements. I think a lot of the time, very valuable or very original art, it comes from a place where you have a certain, maybe the artist has a certain goal, but it's kind of interfered by their specific limitations. So it's kind of like where their ambition meets their limitation, and it kind of creates something very specific. I sat through this talk with some guy who worked with Stanley Kubrick. I think it was an actor who worked with Stanley Kubrick at some point. And I really like this quote from him that he told this guy, that apparently he said, most of the time, I have no idea what it is exactly that I'm trying to accomplish or get, but I know exactly what I don't want. And I think that's like a really interesting statement coming from him, because it seems like in his work that he has everything like so specifically drawn out, and everything's like meticulously crafted, but I don't know exactly the extent to which that's like holds up. Like I think there's maybe quite a lot of estimation going on of like, I don't think this is exactly right, that's not exactly right either, but this is definitely wrong, you know what I mean? That definitely doesn't fit, that definitely doesn't fit. And you can kind of estimate and arrive at a like a very, very amazing, amazing film by an accumulation of these rejections of everything that doesn't work. You're left over with all the things that work very well.
The European Echo podcast was brought to you by European Echo. The theme was Cass by Jim Clemmos. If you like the podcast and would like to hear more, you can subscribe on the podcast app on your phone or on iTunes. You could also head to the European Echo site at europeanecho.com or like us on Facebook.